thank you, Glenn and Nancy and Barbara. I'm honored to be here. I want to dedicate my talk to the woman I love, Dusty. She's been the light of my life, and she literally saved me so from all sorts of things. And we are a creative team. She's the more the feminine side, and we balance well. So I have a lot to communicate in a very short time. I'll tell you in advance, I do have a stuttering habit, so don't be concerned. I'm not having a heart attack. I do speak rather fast. That's how I mask it. I use a lot of Latin terminology. I will clausically define the common terms whenever I do use Latin terms. I'm wearing my mushroom hat. This hat is made from Phomys fomentarius, which is a birch polypore. And this mushroom was absolutely pivotal in the evolution of humans as we migrated from Africa into the European climates. This mushroom allowed for the portability of fire. You can hollow this mushroom out, stuff it with embers from a fire, and you can carry it literally for days. Now, plants and mushrooms achieve a level of shamanic importance, not because of one reason, but I think because of a multiplicity of advantages. This mushroom, when you boil it in water, has very strong antimicrobial properties, which you'll see. And then when you pound it, it becomes a fabric. And this fabric then could be made into clothing, hats, you know, garments, shirts, etc. And if it's smeared with animal fat, it becomes waterproof. So having this, being able to transport fire, especially in winter time when we were nomadic peoples and clan running in clans, the firekeeper was absolutely critical to the survival of the clan. And this is the type of ancestral knowledge that has almost been lost. There's a group of ladies in Romania that have kept this tradition alive. And this is, I have several of these hats. This is my favorite one. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. We represent the body intellect of ancestral knowledge. And knowledge has been passed down from family to family and from generation to generation. It's so important that we pass knowledge down to younger people. I got into the field of mycology when I was around 17 years of age, and I was fortunate that I entered into a circle of the greatest mycologists in North America, and they kind of took me under their wing. I had hair down to my waist, I had a long beard, I was a total hippie, and I went into a very conservative scientific arena. I wanted to mention also that in 1976, Mike Mackey, I think I met Mark Music right around that period of time, but that's when I first was introduced to Tilt and became a member. It was outside of Portland, Oregon. I think it was Tigard. I'm just really pushing my memory here. I just remember a long chicken shed that had been made into an office. So if anybody has a memory of that, I'd like to know where it was. But the Tilth movement, you know, really was the foundation of the organic movement. And I just came back from Washington, D.C., and meeting with the EPA, with the very top people in the EPA. And so I want to tell you about some of my discoveries and inventions. I will say some pretty crazy, radical things. I went to the Evergreen State College and graduated from there. But I've had a series of major epiphanies in the past several years. And it's because I believe in natural intelligence. I believe the genome is intelligent. And I have excellent reasons for saying this. And I now have proof to show you that that presumption has led downstream into some huge discoveries, which can impact everybody in this room. So I hope that from this talk, your lives will be forever changed, and you'll engage fungi as allies, because they are the integral interface organisms between in the food chain and recycling waste products and building soil. So, okay, I'm going to rock and roll. If we can have the lights totally turned down, I would appreciate it. I'm going to stand behind this slide projector, because if I walk around here, I'll obscure some of you. So if that's okay with you, I'll be behind the slides. And then at the very end, I'll open up for some questions. And this afternoon, I have another workshop, which will be more on gardening with fungal allies and simple strategies for projecting mycelium. We have 10,000 square feet of clean rooms now. We have four laboratories. We live outside of Olympia, Washington. And we have several hundred species in our culture library. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. I could, and I have a new book coming out, and I'm going to promote myself here. But in the spring, I have a book coming out called Mycelium Running, which is a book about habitat restoration strategies using fungi as keystone species. I'm going to get a sip of water here before I start. So,
I'm going to find my laser pointer here. Oh, good. Excellent.
This is where Dusty and I live. Wow, look at the size of that laser pointer. It's huge. Whoa, there's the farm. Okay. So we have 17 acres right on Skookum Inlet. It's a little spur inlet off of Totten. We're northwest of Olympia at the base of the Olympic Peninsula. Now, I spend an enormous amount of time taking photographs. I spend $20,000 a year, at least, on photography. I haven't migrated to PowerPoint yet because, frankly, it's a license to steal. And I just want to say that, you know, for those of you who are photographers or are using other people's images, please give credit to the photographers. It's really important. In this case, I hired an airplane, went around my property three times, and the window was always in the way. So I told the pilot, go around again, and when I tell you to drop the wing, drop it. But I'm going to do something. Don't be concerned. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I paid you already, right? He goes, yes. I said, well, just do what I say then, please. So he came around again, and then I opened up the door of the airplane, took off my seatbelt, right? And then I told him to drop the wing. Well, being an idiot that I am, I didn't know that gravity still worked. And so I actually fell out of the airplane, hold on to the seatbelt with my Nikon camera, and boom, 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 I got this image, you know? So I go to extraordinary efforts to get my photographs. And those of you who are photographers, you know, it's an art and a science. And I just really want to recommend that people who are using other people's images, please give the photographers credit. You know, some of us, you know, spend a lot of energy putting it together. So we live at the base of the Olympic Peninsula, and that's why I located there. We have this 47 miles of contiguous old-growth forest, basically from this ridgeline north. And it's an intact genome, and Dusty and I like to go in the woods with frequency. On Sundays, this is where we go to church. We like to go into these cathedral forests. And she has Albatrellus hirtus, which is one of the old ancient polypores. And we go into the old-growth forest, and we look for species that are either rare or have something, some magical quality to them. And we take a small sample of the mushroom, or just one mushroom, and we clone it. And we like to go especially into endangered ecosystems where there's a clear cut that's going to occur, or there's, you know, parking lots are being put up. I mean, there's all these treasured little biomes that are disappearing. And in those biomes are really important fungal species, and we like to capture them or be able to clone them so they don't become extinct. So this is one of our escapades, and I like to say that Dusty's pack was a lot bigger than mine. So we went up and set up a base station. And then we go in for several days, up to a week, week and a half at a time. Dusty is skilled in plant identification. I know mushroom taxonomy well. And so once we get into the Alpine Lakes region, because of the trout up there are quote-unquote an invasive species, and they want them fished out. There's no fishing limit in the Alpine Lakes. So we go up there, and once we're up in the high country, we can stay up there for a long, long time, which is great. The mushrooms that we collect stay alive for days, sometimes for weeks, depending on what species they are, and we pack them in snowdrifts or we keep them cool, and then we can bring them back into the laboratory and make clones of them. Some of the mushrooms that are grown are mycorrhizal. That grow in the forest are mycorrhizal. They have a symbiotic relationship with the roots of plants. This is Rosites caparata, the gypsy mushroom. This is a mycorrhizal species which has not yet been cultivated. But it has made medical news because it contains a novel class of antiviral medicines that are unique to mushrooms. And Dr. Frank Prano from the University of Wisconsin Medical School identified RC-183, which is effective against the varicella zoster virus, herpes simplex 1 and 2, and influenza A, and some other centennial respiratory viruses. This has really awoken the medical community at looking at mushrooms as sources for novel medicines. And for the need for antibacterial agents as well as novel antiviral agents, you can imagine that now, because of this gateway species, there's a lot of interest in this subject. So I at the Evergreen State College, I was a scanning electron microscopist. I taught electron microscopy there for several years. I have thousands of electron micrographs. So we're going to look at the gills. On the gills of the mushroom are these cells called basidia, and the basidia enlarge. And these are stalagmati, and as at the tips of these, spores form. Typically with mushrooms, there are four spores per basidium. And as the basidia mature, they look like these little seed pods, and indeed they are. And these spores are jettisoned into space at 45-degree angles approximately, with an enormous amount of force. An article came out in Mycologia stating that these are actually called, they should be called ballistospores, because they are escaping, they are being emitted off of the basidium in paired opposites. And so if this one does not go, this one doesn't go. They simultaneously go off. There's a sugar sheath that is liquid just before the spores are being ejected into space. And the spores bend over and a gas bubble forms at that junction. And then they simultaneously explode. And they're sent off at a force of 25,000 Gs, 10,000 times that which a space shuttle astronauts experience escaping the gravitational pull of the Earth. So this is that nature has a better propulsion system than anything that NASA has designed. And I think this we need to go back and look at nature more carefully, because there's so many incredible inventions that are already in the natural landscape, and this represents one. So after the spores are sent into space, then these spores then go, then the basidia collapse, and then these are young basidia that emerge. And so there's an increasing crescendo of basidia and sporulation as the mushrooms mature. Now, this is a rushless species in a meadow in the Olympics. This is over past its prime. So mushrooms produce natural antibiotics because they don't want the rot from bacteria. So they climax, and then after they sporulate to their maximum, they die back. Their immune system goes into decline, and then they're parasitized by bacteria, and insects are attracted. And as a result, they became food bodies and a habitat for species, for many other different biological species. So we're going to look at this mushroom as it declines. This is the mushroom as it begins to rot. And there's an enormous amount of spore germination from those spores. And there's other fungi that are growing also on this mushroom. But watch what happens. And this mushroom sort of just melts into the landscape. And this is represented of the mycelial state, which is really the predominant state that these fungi exist in. Some fungi will not produce mushroom fruit bodies for literally decades, maybe hundreds of years. There's 1 to 2 million species of fungi in the genome. Approximately 10% are mushrooms. We've identified 14,000 species to date. So we estimate that there's 140 to 160 species out there, 140 to 160,000 species out there, which have not been identified, meaning 90% of the mushrooms in the genome have never produced a fruit body, or one that that scientists have actually recognized and be able to type it to species. So there's an enormous amount in the genome that we have not yet discovered. So we'll look at this microscopically. And one of my projects at Evergreen State College was looking at filtration media. And it was amusing to me because nothing that the scientific supply companies could provide ever came close to the microarchitecture of the mushroom mycelium. This is only one cell wall thick, and it's in direct contact with hundreds of millions of other organisms per gram all around it. We have 5 or 6 skin layers that protect us from the outside. The mushroom mycelium has one cell layer thick. And on this surface area is an enormous number of receptor sites that allows the mycelium to react to catastrophia and to be able to grow and to be able to prevent parasitization. So I was amazed that in looking at the mycelium, it became captivating to me that it's a filtration membrane in and of itself. It captures nutrient flows. It grows towards moist environments. If there is a flow of water carrying organic debris, it catches that debris and decomposes it. And then looking at evolutionary biology, we know now that 465 million years ago, we shared a common ancestry with fungi. And when these aquatic organisms hit the beach, then they had to produce skeletal structures that would prevent them from dehydration. We chose the path of encirculating our nutrients, basically a stomach, and producing acids and enzymes internally. The mushroom mycelium and fungi in general chose the path of externally producing its enzymes and acids, digesting organic plant material external to his network, and then selectively usurping nutrients. And so we respire carbon dioxide, and so do the fungi. They absorb oxygen. And we share more in common with our DNA with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. So I postulated this idea of a fungal intelligence in an article in the Whole Earth Review about 8 years ago. Then I was very delighted to see this article that came out in Nature Science. And this is from a slime mold called Fusarium polycephalum. And it is an agar gel maize. And first they ran the culture through the maize, and then they took the culture, and then they started the culture again, and they gave it two food sources. And this organism memorized the maize pathway, apparently, and then in the most proximate distance possible, split itself and went to the two food sources, even though it was in remote contact. It was well remote from direct contact. Thus, these Japanese researchers postulated this demonstrates cellular intelligence, that these organisms actually have a memory. They can intelligently sense food sources, hundreds of microns away from their existence. I hired another airplane in the search of the largest organism in the world, which is a mycelial mat in Oregon. It's 2,400 acres in size. It is 2,200 years old. It has climaxed the old-growth forest at least five or six times. And 12,000 years ago, when the ice age receded, scraped away most of the soil. So we had like soil lenses of sand, but we had very, very little humus. It is the role of these fungi, I believe, in the broadest perspective, even the parasitic fungi, to build soil, ultimately to help biological communities downstream. And so this is one in Washington State that's 1,200 acres. And what it does, they tend to form at the tops of mountains. And I think these are the meadow makers, because we up in the Alpine and the higher regions, we were always fascinated why you have these tree islands and then you have these vast meadows. And so when the trees are killed, they dry out, they become highly flammable, and then lightning strikes. And at the tips of these mountains, this is where the big fires start. So in looking at the 10,000-year perspective on the role of these fungi in nature, they climax these forests. And in doing so, they begin to sapropitize them, and they build soil. And so we have now a soil depth here on this side of Washington, except in the river valleys, that's only 6 inches to a foot deep. I was a logger for several years. I set chokers, and I was a rigging slinger. I worked in the wood products community, and it always blew me away that we had like several times one log loads, right? One tree filled an entire logging truck, and more often three log loads. But I was amazed that 1 acre, you could pull off hundreds of tons of carbon. And I thought to myself, where the heck is this carbon coming from? And the idea of that forestry or growing trees is America's renewable resource is one of the biggest lies of the logging industry that has ever been perpetrated. You start cutting these trees, in three generations, and 10 generations will be like Ireland. We're going to end up with a very, very thin humus layer. So the role of these fungi, I think, need to be looked upon not in the context of your lifetime, but in the context of dozens of generations. And then we can really see what they're doing. So I respect things that are much bigger than me. And, 2,400 acres is a massive organism. And looking at the mycelium under the microscope, I inevitably came to the idea that these are neurological landscapes that are coursing through the environment. They're sentient, they're intelligent, they've been around for as long as we have. Why wouldn't they be intelligent? I had an excellent series of arguments in public with another individual who said, Stamets, you make these crazy comments that nature is intelligent. How is this possible? And I retorted back to him, consider the hypocrisy of your statement. The very brain that nature gave you is articulating the thought to make the objection that nature is intelligent. I mean, So this is a photograph by Hank Morgan, which shows astrocytes, which are neurons, which cluster also in a mycelial-like form. And this is something that I want to bring up because one of my spiritual insights. Is that I'm also an amateur astronomer, And those of you who've been following astronomy, we have a disconcerting fact now that 96% of the matter in the universe is unaccounted for, and it's being called dark matter. So this is from the Virgo Consortium, and this shows the organization of dark matter, which conforms to string theory. Now this is in the most macro of scales, and it's mycelial-like and its architecture. And this is from Scientific American, and this is a diagram of the computer internet. And the invention of the computer internet I see as an inevitable consequence in evolutionary biology. I think matter breeds life, and the simplest forms of life is mitotic cell divisions at that form. And these neurological landscapes that are present in the environment is the model that we have used for our own neurology, and the invention of the computer internet is an inevitable consequence at a time that we need to share information, just like these mycelial nets also share information. So now we're going to go way out, and this is the cobweb of dark matter, another photograph from Scientific American, and these are galaxies. And it gives you a perspective on these huge scales of space, the organization of matter. And so now we're going to look at one of these galaxies. And this is galaxy 2701. This is from the Hubble. I don't know because the Hubble is the photographer. And this is in Ursa Major. And as matter coalesces and forms because of gravitational flux, etc., and then they tend to form these cyclonic forms. And these spiraling galaxies, I think, is another archetype of nature. And this just the way it is, you know, in our universe. And this is Hurricane Isabella. It's also from NASA. And the form of the hurricanes and the form of galaxies conform to the same archetype. Now I'm going to zoom in now, and this is an amazing series. This amazing two photographs. This is from a Montana researcher whose name right now I don't recall, but this is a honey mushroom mat, similar to the one that you saw before that was massive. That was 1,200 acres. This one's only 21 acres, but there's no obstruction, no geographical wall of rock or whatever to prevent the mycelium from forming in its natural form. And this is a culture that I took, which I saw this same cyclonic form. And it follows Fibonacci's constant, which is 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34. It's the basis of the mathematics of spirals. And I think now that this is the way of most of these cultures, is they will form these spiraling forms if grown to a large enough degree and it doesn't have uninterrupted or inconsistent food sources. And so I think this is maybe what all these cultures are doing or trying to do or naturally forming, but we don't have that perspective. This one kind of shows it. So ultimately what we're trying to create, where we grow, is mycelium. And this is a rhizomorph, which is a braided strand of mycelium. And this is what we call happy mycelium. It's very, very aggressive, root-like in its form. And as a cultivator, this is really what we try to promote, is this tenacious, vigorous growth of mycelium. Is the electron micrograph similar to the other one? You can grow mushrooms on all sorts of materials. You can grow mushrooms on chairs. This is a friend of mine. He's growing pink oysters and white oysters. He was actually a performance artist who came to one of my workshops. And then he went around Europe doing performance art, growing oyster mushrooms. And then we have a big banquet at night, and they'd eat the mushrooms, you know. So I never would have thought of this. In a thousand years, I never would have thought of doing performance art with mushrooms. So he gets the credit for that. You can grow oyster mushrooms on money, which is a fabulous substrate. Most of you know that you're in violation of the federal drug code because you have hemp in your wallets, in your purses. Money is made from hemp and cotton. The highest biological efficiency, which means the highest yield that I've ever seen from any agricultural product thus far, has been coming from a combination of hemp and cotton. Oyster mushrooms contain some very interesting medicinal compounds. They have a natural form of lovastatin, which the FDA has has approved that drug as an anti-cholesterol drug, and most of you are quite familiar with it. Lipitor is another one. And oyster mushrooms contain the isomers of levostatin and about six or seven related, closely related compounds in their molecular architecture. A study came out of Eastern Europe that if you eat 15 dry grams of oyster mushrooms per day, you'll reduce your LDL cholesterol by 30%. You know, a substantial reduction of your LDL cholesterol. Certainly beats the pants out of what was just announced recently with the injection of HDLs. This got a number of people excited. Another series of research papers came out showing there's a novel glycoprotein that has antiviral properties against HIV. We put this data together. We made a submission to NIH, and we have just been funded for a $300,000 clinical study at San Francisco General Hospital with HIV patients who have a problem with protease inhibitors because it interferes with lipid metabolism in the liver. And so they have an enormous accumulation of LDLs, which leads to arteriosclerosis and all sorts of other diseases. And so NIH has now funded us. We have grown up. We're growing up the crop now. And in January, we start a small clinical study for AIDS patients. So it's the first clinical study with medicinal mushrooms in the United States. So we're really, really happy about that. So, and I want to segue into showing you that these are medicinal foods, and we can recycle all sorts of the farm waste products that you folks are involved in generating, and in the course of this, we build soil. So we did an experiment right here in Bellingham, Washington. Many of you have heard about this. There was several competing research techniques for breaking down hydrocarbon-saturated soils, and I was working with Battelle Laboratories for about 4 years. We have a patent pending on breaking down toxic waste using mycelium. They came to one of my workshops. Six of them did. I trained them in cell line propagation in the laboratory. And then we started doing different things of starving the mycelium from its natural nutrients and replacing that with toxins. And we found that the mycelium was able to adapt to the toxin as a food source and articulate a enzymatic pathway that would actually degrade it and break it. So that was real exciting. And so up here in Bellingham, this is a Department of Transportation storage a bus lot where there's all sorts of saturated diesel saturated in the soil. And so there were several competing companies and scientists that tried to remediate this heavily saturated soil. It had 10,000 parts per million of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, about 1%, which is roughly that which the with Exxon Valdez dumped on the beaches in Alaska. And so we introduced our oyster mushroom mycelium into the pile. And this is what the mycelium does. It's a highly absorbent sponge. It absorbs water. And in this case, it absorbs the oil, then the mycelium becomes black. It metabolizes the oil as a food source, and it produces lignine peroxidases, or lignases, as well as cellulases. Lignine peroxidases and cellulases break hydrogen-carbon bonds, and that is the basis of hydrocarbons, which is most of our fuels and pesticides. And so it turned out to be a really great species to use for bioremediation of toxic waste. And so the mycelium becomes black, and then it metabolizes, it becomes white again. And this is significant. Because then, 4 weeks later, we came back, we opened up the tarps, and all the other piles were black and stinky, smelling like hydrocarbons and oil. And they came to our tarp, pulled back our tarp, and we had hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms growing on this saturated soil. And the pile went blonde, right? It's no longer black. All the other piles were black and stinky. And we broke down the PAHs from 10,000 parts per million to less than 200 in 8 weeks, which the other research scientists said this is impossible. They made us repeat the experiment. We did. And there were 21 competing research proposals at Battelle, and we scored number one. And so we had continued funding. Now, the common question is, were the mushrooms edible? And we had them analyzed, and there was no petroleum products that were residual in the mushrooms whatsoever. And so we don't know for sure. We didn't do any total characterization of the mushrooms, but apparently they are perfectly edible. If the mushrooms were in a heavy metal toxic environment, I would not say that, because I'll come to that in a minute. So, but something else happened. Well, the mushrooms got very large. And those of you who collect oyster mushrooms, they're normally about 2 to 4 inches in diameter. These are happy mushrooms, you know, which reflects the fact that we were able to metabolize the nutrients in that substrate and articulate a very large fruiting structure. Now, it's oftentimes said that mushrooms are to the mycelium what an apple is to an apple tree, more like an apple to the rootstock of an apple tree. But then they sporulate, and flies are attracted from great distances. This is the bane of mushroom cultivators, is forage flies and other flies are attracted by the spores, and they come into the mushrooms, and they start laying eggs. And that's why you find all these maggots in mushrooms. And so what happened later, after 2 weeks later, was something that was very interesting, and it progressed for several weeks before the pile was scooped up, is the mushrooms attracted flies, the flies laid eggs, the larvae developed, the larvae then became a food source for birds, and then there's windblown seeds that were brought in, but at the end of the experiment, our pile was an oasis of life. It was a green berm, and all the other piles that were using enzymatic and chemical treatments were dead, lifeless, and neutral environments. But this led me to the concept of using these primary saprophytes for habitat restoration because they are keystone species that lead the way, and other biological communities soon follow. So I'll talk more about this afternoon, but this is kind of a taste of where I'm going. So then we started working with Amazon Watch, and many of you probably heard about this incredible oil disaster in Ecuador because of Chevron and Texaco. And a group of native peoples came up and filed a lawsuit in San Francisco. It's a multi-billion dollar lawsuit. We have been working with Amazon Watch, XSAccess.org, and another nonprofit. The mother of invention oftentimes is comes from such strange places. This guy has he's a hairdresser in San Francisco, and he has a patent on absorbing oil with hair. And so he caters mostly to ladies, and so he's mobilized this huge hair substrate stream to collect hair in mass, and then we soak up the oil. So when we connected with him, we thought, well, the problem, you can soak up the oil really, really well with hair, but now how do you get rid of the oil? So we saprophytized the oil, the hair that's saturated with oil, with oyster mushrooms. And so it just shows you how these links just begin with, you know, very, very creative processes. Our group was supposed to go down there last week to Quito, and then 500 reporters showed up. It's a huge lawsuit. Anything that our experts say could be used against these Indians in the lawsuit. So we are holding back until it kind of the dust settles. But if this lawsuit goes through and Chevron and Texaco are found guilty, this will set a precedent internationally, which will probably have huge ramifications. As many of you know, the pollution problems elsewhere in the world are much greater than we have here because of the EPA, et cetera. So Dusty and I, this is in the Lower Ho River Valley. These are spruces. And we love going into these environments. And it's a great place to get away from the phone and the internet and everything else. And we like to go, you know, when you go in the first day, you meet all the day hikers. You go in the second day, you're meeting some of the hardcore people. The third day that you're in, 3 days from the trailhead, I mean, that's really where you meet the most interesting individuals, you know. And we love going deep in. And some of the mushrooms that grow in the old growth forest are of particular interest to us. This is Ganoderma aplanatum, which is one of the biggest polypores in the world. This one here is about, I don't know, probably about 40 years of age. This is Steve Cervantes, one of our top employees who found it. And he took us into the old growth forest, and you got to see this artist conch. It's huge. So we went there, and I said, Steve, you know, we really should get a culture from this thing. And Steve was ready to break the thing off. And I go, no, let's not do that. It's an elder. You know, this thing needs to be respected. We don't need to take the mushroom. All we need is a piece of tissue over here the size of your thumbnail. And so I took my knife out, carved a little piece off of it, took it back into, and Steve also brought his son, which is just a natural born mushroom hunter. He's on his path. So, and we took it back in the laboratory, we cloned it, and now we have it growing. So that very mushroom still exists in the old growth forest, but now we've captured the phenotype. We do no GMO work. We go after phenotypes in nature. We can clone mushrooms or generate cultures from spores. Spores give you multiple genotypes. When you clone, when a clone a mushroom, you capture the phenotype. So you're representative. You have a representative of that contributing individual. So this is an example of what I think is important that we do is go into the environment before some of these ancestral strains are lost. An excellent article by six pharmaceutical employees out of Spain, Suay et al., S-U-A-Y et alia. We have a micromedicinal booklet that Dustin and I wrote that talks about this. Surveyed 204 species of mushrooms. 75% of the polypores, and this is called a polypore, have antimicrobial activity. What's really interesting about this article that came out 2 years ago is there is target species specificity in matching different mushroom species against different bacterial colonies. And so you can mix and match. And this mushroom, as well as another one I'll show you, is effective against Staphylococcus aureus, which is a staph bacterium, which causes all sorts of diseases, of course. And so there's an example that these mushrooms are producing antibiotics. And the antibiotics are novel, and oftentimes novel to that very species.
What were you growing it on?
We're growing on alder sawdust. We primarily use alder because it's a non-controversial wood. And that's where that we've adapted our strains to be able to grow an alder. Using a similar technique of introducing alder sawdust into the agar media in the laboratory. So this is called the artist conch because you can draw on it. And native peoples all over the world recognize this. And we also grow lots of reishi, Ganoderma lucidum. This is in our growing rooms. And we grow, commercially we have about 20 species that we, or maybe 25 that we are marketing right now out of the several hundred in our culture collection. This is my good friend, Dr. Andrew Weil. And Andy and I have been working together, you know, for many, many years. And we have several other research projects that are ongoing. He's has the program for integrative medicine at the University of Arizona Medical School in Tucson. And he's a strong proponent of using medicinal mushrooms as adjunct therapies. And this is where the medical community is really woken up is how do you help the immune system after you've been treated with chemotherapy or radiation? Building the immune system is extremely important. He's big on preventive medicine, using these medicinal mushrooms in order to prevent diseases. Of course, the pharmaceutical industry has no profit incentive for preventing diseases. They want to make the money after you get the disease, and then you have to buy the pharmas from them. There's a ton of information I have on these things. This is turkey tail, Trimedes versicolor. The old name is Coriolis versicolor. It is one of the most ubiquitous fungi in the world. It is breaks down PCBs. There's several patents and articles on this mushroom. It also contains PSK, crestin, which is the subject of a large clinical study in Asia. And one of these studies made and was published in The Lancet, which is like the New England Journal of Medicine. It's 252 patients with gastric cancer and chemotherapy. Those that got an extract of this mushroom at a 22% increase in the 5-year disease-free survival. Taking this mushroom compared to the controls that didn't have it. So when this was published in the medical community, really started waking up, looking at medicinal mushrooms as being very, very powerful immune-enhancing fungi. And I could talk, I have an enormous amount of data on medicinal mushrooms, which I can't talk about in the course of this. But we grow it. And this is one of the strains that we grew in that St. Mary's Hospital. It was tested in vitro against prostate cancer cell lines as well as non-cancer cell lines, and it caused apoptosis, programmed cell death of the cancerous cells when exposed to the fractions of this mushroom, leaving the healthy cells intact. Again, target specificity. And this is why it's got the medical community very excited. We have a clinical study application with Bastyr College in Seattle with a group of breast cancer patients. The NIH, we scored quite high on the review. Actually, higher than we did with the oyster mushroom, study. But there's some other complicating factors so we have to resubmit. But there's a team of about 8 of us that are working on this clinical study application. We hope to be approved by June, and we can start the clinical studies with breast cancer in January. So one of the mushrooms in the course of my research with Battelle Laboratories. Dephosphorylated VX, broke down VX, and this was published in Jane's Defense Weekly, for those of you that have any military background, and broke down VX in a heretofore unprecedented fashion. There's a phosphorus bond that's extremely difficult to break down. Now, I've been I've been encouraged not to publicly announce what these species are because of this whole threat now of bioterrorism, and I want to live a long life and all that stuff. But I've been able to articulate the argument that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense. Yeah. And this is where I was a logger, I was a hippie, and I saw all this demonizing of the opposition on the other side. And you know, Ed, Dusty's brother actually worked in the White House for a number of years, and the Republicans don't care about the spotted owl. That's the wrong flag to fly. They don't give a hoot. They don't give a hoot about all sorts of things. You talk to them about bioterrorism and national defense, and now I've gotten a lot of attention that we should protect our genome. Because this is actually part of our armamentarium to prevent bioterrorist threats, and our genome is extremely important not only now but for future generations. This has actually resounded very, very well within the intelligence community. And if I can save the old growth forest by getting the Defense Department to say we should do so, then so be it. So I just wanted to put it out there that we need to build bridges of communications. You can argue all day long about the old growth forest and spotted owl and get nowhere. You find a linkage like this, and then people are all on the same page. Then, well, why didn't you bring this up before? Of course we have to save the old growth forest. I mean, so it just erases all those obstacles, and I encourage all of you to reach out to those people that are not politically of your bent. So I'm going to jump to the Iceman now, because it's one of my favorite subjects. This is a photograph by Reinhold Poter at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. The Iceman was found in the fall of 1994 on the border of Austria and Italy. Some tourists who actually were quite astute ad hoc scientific team found this dead person in the ice. And the ice had receded to the lowest level in 5,000 years. The body's 5,300 years of age. They notified the local Italian constable. And they said, oh, it's another dead hiker. We see them all the time. You know, he goes, no, you don't understand. So they went to the Austrian officials a few hundred feet away on the border and said, hey, we found a dead guy up here. You should go check it out. And they checked it out. And, of course, it's the best preserved remains of a human ever found in a non-funeral setting where he died. And I think most of you know he had a spear point, arrowhead in his ribs. He lived for several days subsequently. But the Iceman had with him some very interesting stuff. He had three polypores, two of which were tethered to his right side with this little leather thong, and one of them was in a little pouch. Now, he had these polypores that he had, we kind of know their use now. One of them was Piptoporus betulinus, the birch polypore, which concentrates betulin out of birch bark. So those of you who are real keen and hip on birch bark tea, well, our ancestors realized that these mushrooms concentrated the active constituents and allowed also for portability. It was a more concentrated medicine. And this is repeated over and over with fungi. Taxol, which comes from the yew tree, is concentrated by Taxomyces androniana, which is a fungus that grows on the yew tree. And we can go over this over and over again. These fungi are bioaccumulators of many of these very important active constituents. This is a soft polypore. Beetles bore through it, lay eggs in it. The larvae develop. The beetles go out. They bore. They get covered with spores by going through this spore-producing layer here, and they burrow into a tree and they infect it. This is the way of nature, is that fungi and insects have a very, very sophisticated relationship that we're just discovering what that relationship is. The other mushroom was the one I held up. It's made of the hat. It's Phomys fomentarius. And Phomys fomentarius was one of the cultures that I gave Vittel Laboratories, and we had found an astonishing property, also never been published in the scientific literature, that quite surprised us. And Phomys fomentarius is what the fabric looks like. When you boil the mushroom and pound it, it separates into mycelium. I published an article in Herbalgram, and Mark Blumenthal, I just begged him, please publish this photograph, which is also by Reinhold Poter. And what is so important about this, it bridges the concept of mycelium and mushrooms. The mushrooms are made of compacted mycelium that articulates at the end of its life cycle into unique structures. But when you take the mushroom, you clone it, or in this case, you pound it, it separates into those individual hyphae. And this also, if you go in the Oxford English Dictionary, punk came from these mushrooms, an enormous trade in Eastern Europe
and collecting these birch polypores because it helped revolutionize warfare. When flint spark guns were being made, they couldn't get the spark to hit the gunpowder. So they created this fabric, which is highly flammable, which we knew for hundreds of years, and that revolutionized warfare. Now, Fomes fomentarius has been said to be the oldest manipulated biological product ever found in a prehistoric site, 12,000 years BP. And so at prehistoric sites, they find these tinder fungi, and this, you know, again, was extremely important for human survival. So you can, here's the one that we collected in the wild. They can be a blonde color like this, or they can be, and the one in the center is one that we grew. And there's another one of the hats that these ladies have made. So this is what it looks like in culture. This is Fomes fomentarius here. This is the dreaded 0157 strain of E. coli, for which there is no cure. And there is, these are the enzymatic droplets. This is a photograph by Suzanne Thomas from Battelle, and as the next four photographs I'm going to show you. And then in advance of the mycelium riding on osmotic pressure wave, we found something that was very interesting. And this first shows the metabolic sweat or enzymes that are extracellular being secreted by the mycelium. And this is like dripping like rain. This is wicking constantly. If this is a motion picture, you just see this enormous number of droplets that are being produced. But in these droplets, there's some very interesting crystals. And here's the mycelium of Fomes fomentarius. And advancing on osmotic pressure wave are these crystalline messenger entities. We don't know what to call them. They're octahedral in size. And they go in advance of the mycelium. They encounter an antigen, or maybe a food source, or maybe, you know, some other type of biological or nutritional event. We really don't know. And they disintegrate. And as they disintegrate, they apparently give a chemical feedback loop to the mycelium. And the mycelium then customizes a response in producing these secondary crystals, which then become strange attractants to the E. coli. The E. coli are motile, so they're moving around. They go to these secondary crystals. They cluster around these crystals. They stop moving. The mycelium advances and gobbles them up. Now, how far does this go? When you're looking at a map that's 2,400 acres in size, you look at the innate intelligence, just a mammoth size of the largest organism in the world. I mean, it must be articulating and customizing responses all around it here to, you know, just of enormous complexity. So this is just the beginning of what we think is happening. No, the crystalline entity disintegrates, but it's produced by the mother mycelium in the center of the mat. So these crystals actually are formed quite remotely after these octahedral crystals, or we call them messenger crystals, advance. Then as they disintegrate, the mother mycelium produces another crystal, apparently customized to the antigen. The crystals do disintegrate, but it's part of this feedback loop. And, you know, I would ask, well, why wouldn't it do that? I mean, it seems to me it's great to have a scalp out there, or a scalp mechanism beforehand. So I'll show you a little bit of what I'm talking about this afternoon. And we've had some major great breakthroughs, and the big chasm in projecting mycelium is you grow it in a laboratory under sterile conditions, and then you put it outside. Well, it's in a laboratory with no contact with other microorganisms. You throw it outside where there's hundreds of millions of organisms per gram, and it's oftentimes too much for the mycelium. It dies back. So what we've developed at Fungi Perfecti is some very cool, simple techniques. And I'm going to show them because this is something that you all can practice. And I'll talk more about it this afternoon. Is we have found the wonders of burlap sacks. And burlap sacks, we fill them with wood chips, unsterilized raw wood chips. We don't have to sterilize, pasteurize, chemically treat them whatsoever. And what we have discovered really is that the fabric of the burlap. And it's like same self-recognition in the microarchitecture of the mycelium advances different orders of magnitude of size. The mycelium loves fabrics. It is a fabric. And so you can put raw spawn throughout the wood chips here, and it won't grow. But if you put spawn, or I'll show you other techniques later on this afternoon that are even simpler, you put the mycelium at the fabric level, which totally breathes, and you get enormous, enormous, exquisite growth. And so it's extremely easy to develop these burlap sacks. And then now we have a method, and this is what my new book is about, of customizing host defense strategies in farms and around industries and around sensitive ecosystems that are target specific to the biological pathogen, in this case E. coli, or Listeria, Fisteria, or all sorts of other types of contaminants, even those which are petroleum based. And then we can make this bunker spawn like sandbags as peripheral buffers that will protect ecosystems. And the mycelium becomes a microfiltration membrane. And now we have an extremely simple method of generating hundreds of tons of this material at a very little expense. And so this is kind of our big breakthrough, is how do I make it available to everybody? Because everybody can't, build a laboratory or have the skill base. It's a lot more complicated. So we have several sort of breakthrough simple techniques, and this is one of them. And so you can then, use this, and as it decomposes, it makes soil. And I will show that more of that later. Or you can grow oyster mushrooms directly out of the burlap sack. What we have done at our place is we have a pond, and we have a microfiltration cement chamber. And the pond, we measured upstream the amount of the five most prominent bacteria. And then we've been putting these burlap sacks into the slough of the pond. And as the water goes through the burlap sacks, it, quote-unquote, charges the mycelium with water and nutrients. And we have been doing analyses, and the story gets better and better. With every species that we put into the burlap sack, it changes the population of bacteria downstream. So upstream, the most prominent bacterium was Pseudomonas fluorescens. It goes through the microfilter of the burlap sack. The most prominent organism downstream is Bacillus subtilis, which is the most friendly bacterium in the world. We all have it on us. And so, wow, this is the way of nature. Now we can employ these fungal allies as microfiltration, buffers, and we can articulate their design customized to the problems of the landscape. And this is just the beginning. But then we start playing around with plant populations. And so, and also a little Douglas fir tree that's in the center of this. So we have burlap sacks with mycelium, with endo and ectomycorrhizal fungi, with saprophytic fungi, and then this is an annual rye. And so then we're looking at putting all sorts of native grasses and building plant successions using burlap sacks as bunker perimeters that do all the things I just talked about, but then leads downstream, growing plant communities. And so this afternoon, again, I'll talk a lot more about these discoveries. Some other mushrooms in the old-growth forest that I think are really important to protect. This is called Agaricon, or Agaricum, Fomitopsis officinalis, first described by Dioscorides in 65 AD as a treatment against consumption. And this mushroom also was very important with a Haida people's origination of women. And it figures prominently in a myth that I'll show you in a minute. And Fomitopsis officinalis produces this anti-tuberculosis-like compound. I've been publishing a lot in peer-reviewed journals. And the good thing about peer review is you actually get some really, really, really salient comments. And I put in there that Fomitopsis officinalis was used as a treatment against tuberculosis. Well, a very good reviewer says, wrong. They didn't know back then that consumption, the coughing illness, was caused by a microorganism. But that led to another thought. Is irrespective of whether you're a doctor or a shaman, you are treating diseases or spirits from the invisible world. So the shamans of old were actually share in common that of modern medicine, and that diseases are being caused by unseen organisms. And so whether it's a spirit or whether it's a microbe, the treatment is the same. And we have right now 65 species at the Center for Disease Control and NIH for a broad-scale antimicrobial screening. And I'm sending them as many old-growth fungi as I can, because I really want to promote this angle of that the genome of the old-growth forest is essential. So this mushroom is very, very... it's a perennial polypore. This one's 35 or 40 years of age. And we clone it down here. And I think this is a fantastic species. It is now thought to be extinct in Europe. So it was figured because of the decline of the forest, and it needs a very massive tree in order to grow. And the origination myth of women were the Haida people. They thought that these were wooden figurines that were deposited in the University of Chicago Field Museum. And then a mycologist by the name of Blanchette, and then Nancy Turner from the University of British Columbia surmised that these were not made of wood at all, but these were made from a mushroom. The mushroom you just saw, Phormatops officinalis. It can have a column shape. And these little shamanic figures were called grave guardians, and they're primarily put on women shamans' graves as a natural protector. So then this has this Venus of Willendorf form, and both in Dioscorides' times as well as the Haida is primarily used by women. And it has this shape, you know, the natural shape of a very well-endowed woman. And, you know, way back, you know, not so way back, but not too long ago, women that were of childbearing age, you know, the larger they were, the more nutrients that they could provide to the children. So it was a sign of wealth. So here's a heart-like plate that is central to the origination myth of women. And this is Raven paddling on these on a canoe in the sea of eternity, and no members of the ecological community could help Raven become a woman. And when finally Raven went to Phormatops officinalis became the oars person that steered the canoe that led Raven to become a woman. So it's central to the origination of myth of women, and thousands of years ago in Greece, it also was central to women's health. I think there's a lot more about the species that has not come to light. So it's one of the other mushrooms that we're very keen on is a mushroom that grows underneath Abies procera, the noble fir. This mushroom is very strange. There's only six locations in Washington and Oregon. It was called Oxyporus nobilismus. Now it's called Brigiaporus nobilismus, the noble polypore. It has this covered with this fur-like coat. It's so soft you can cut it with a butter knife. It lives for decades. Some of us think it lives for hundreds of years in the old-growth forest, and it doesn't rot. This is right near tree line on Mount Rainier. There's up to 6 feet of snow on this under very austere conditions. And this mushroom achieves mammoth sizes. This one is probably 150 pounds. It's about 3 feet across. This one is the largest mushroom in North America. This weighs about 400 pounds, 500 pounds is what we think. It was in the Guinness Book of World Records as the biggest mushroom in the world. Now it's in second place. There's another one called Rigidioporus ulmarius from the Kew Gardens that is larger. It grows and needs this massive tree. So it's not exclusively in the old growth forest, but it needs a population of large diameter trees in order to have a host. It is not parasitic. It appears to be symbiotic. And we've analyzed the DNA several times, and we get a community of DNA from four organisms. And half of us now think that, well, maybe that's correct. It is a community of four organisms. And they've all joined together in order to produce this giant structure. And in doing so, a community is stronger than one individual. Isn't that the way of life anyhow? So we still have not been able to cultivate it to one organism. It's very strange in that regard. So Dusty found this on one of the hoe trails. It's a bear strike. Bear came up to a tree, bam, hit the tree, scraped it down, looking for a grub. And in my area around right out of Shelton, they hired bear hunters, and they virtually made black bears extremely rare in Mason County, because one of my neighbors killed 400 bears hired by Simpson Timber because they thought it threatened their profit wheel by scarring the trees, which caused polypores to grow. It's true. They do cause polypores to grow. A research article came out of the University of British Columbia showing that in habitats where there are salmon runs and bears, the trees achieve large diameters because of the return of nutrients, sea salts, and nitrogen influx from the carcasses of the fish that the bears then pull up on the bank. And in doing so, the phosphorus is a mitigating influence in the absorption of nitrogen into the roots of trees. And this is probably why, many people think now, the trees in the lowland, low-elevation forests are so large in diameters, is they are not nutrient-deprived because the presence of bears in those habitats actually enhance the forest. So again, it takes when you look at the larger picture, you can see things that you would otherwise not see. So one of the mushrooms that the bears make propagate is chicken of the woods, Polyporus sulfurius, Lataporus sulfurius. Most of you probably recognize this. It's more of a summer mushroom, loves to grow in ravines off of hemlocks. Another mushroom that grows back east, this has been long use, is called Inonotus obliquus. In our company, because it sounds like an Agata de Vita, we call it an Agata de Vita mushroom, but it's Inonotus obliquus, you know. Yeah. So it's also known as chaga. It has a very strong anti-cancer property. It's been used by Eastern European peoples for hundreds of years, as well as native peoples in the Northeast. This may become formed of a doctrine of signatures. It looks like cancer, but it treats cancer. Very interesting species in that result. It can be powdered and made into tea. This mushroom also is highly flammable. And we were at a demonstration in Quebec. And this mushroom, you could start a fire with this mushroom, with this powdered material here, in 10 seconds with a flint spark. By taking two pieces of flint, banging them together, and in 10 seconds, you had a fire going. I mean, that is pretty good. So the novelty of these things as fire makers, again, adds meaning to our prehistoric ancestors, as these fungal allies were really important. So I just published an article in a peer-reviewed journal on host defense potentiation, and I'm not going to spend much time on this, but in the series of research trials at a Japanese hospital, we found that you were using human spleen cells, that seven mushrooms in combination had a better effect of any one mushroom by itself, proving synergism. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. There's a journal that I'm a part of called the International Journal of Medicinal Mushrooms. It's been out for about 4 years now. It's by Miguel House. It's a really great journal. And people are contributing it all over the world. Dusty and I are the sponsors of the 2005 International Medicinal Mushroom Conference. About 1,500 to 2,000 people will be coming to that conference. And I highly encourage people here to come because it integrates farming and food with growing mushrooms. Dustin and I just, I went to an FDA GMP meeting, and the subject of bioterrorism came up. And that's a very strange situation now, because most of you know the entire food chain is contaminated. Bill Moyer had a great public television special called Trade Secrets. I don't know if you saw that. It's really good to get that and rent it and be able to watch it. And he had his blood analyzed at Mount Sinai Hospital. In his blood, he had 13 dioxins and 31 PCBs. He had a dozen different pesticides, including DDT, which has not been used in this country for more than 20 years. The problem that we face now as a species is in the past 100 years, we have circulating in our blood and stored in our fatty tissue all sorts of industrial contaminants. Because of the threat of bioterrorism, the FDA has now passed a new act, and December 14th it goes into effect, that no exporter of food into the United States can get their food products into the United States without being registered and certified as having a pollution-free material. Now, this is phenomenal, because now you have strange bedfellows. You have those people who oppose WTO in line with those people who are against bioterrorism. And so it's going to be a huge boon to the organic food industry. And what was stated over and over is as the FDA looks at the food quality, they're horrified at how many heavy metals and pesticides are coming in from foreign countries. And what was stated over and over is the most valuable aspect that we have in this country is certified organic farmers and pollution-free land. And the organic food movement is... So as a result, the organic food movement, I think, is ready to poise for an explosive growth, and organic foods are undervalued. And so this is going to come to a head here in the next 2 years. So, I mean, we're definitely in the right community, and we're going to be recognized increasingly as being as having a very important asset for this country. So I'm going to just end with my one of my discoveries here. Let me have some water. I'm fascinated by the interrelationship between insects and fungi. This is a mushroom called Dictyophora induziata. It's from Africa. And termites grow the mycelium. Many ants and termites are mycophagous. They eat mycelium, they engage it, they grow it. It gives a host defense protection against invasive diseases. There are bacterial colonies that are also associated, which have pesticidal properties, antifungal properties. And so when the colonies are abandoned, then the mushrooms form. But this husbandry between ants and fungi, you know, goes back hundreds of millions of years. Now, Dustin and I live in a really pathetic house. It is so decomposing and slopes 4 inches and 20 feet. It's a flat roof in Washington. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The house is being destroyed by carpenter ants. And so I went on the EPA.gov homepage. And I had a great time telling them just yesterday. It went full circle because how I came to this discovery is I went to the EPA.gov homepage on biopesticides, where they're recommending research and production of biopesticides as an alternative to chemical pesticides. Many of you probably know just last week, 13 more pesticides were banned by the United States and by the United Nations. Chlordane, lindane, dursband, malathion, parathion, they're all banned around the world now because these toxins kill insects quickly, and the EPA has determined that quick contact pesticides tend to be very toxic to the environment. They get into the water table. They have all sort of inadvertent consequences to non-targeted insects. So I started looking at this group of fungi, spurred by my interest in cordyceps. Cordyceps is a mushroom that parasitizes Lepidoptera larvae and then has been well used in China and Tibet for a variety of ailments. It's a natural vasodilator. It's been used as a sexual aphrodisiac. Tibetan guides use this mushroom to combat high altitude sickness. They increase the absorption of oxygen in the lungs. And so cordyceps is a parasitizing fungus on an insect. And so I thought that was very interesting. So I started looking at cordyceps more and started discovering some very bizarre relationships. This is a photograph by Lawrence Gilbert of a carpenter ant in Costa Rica that when it's become infected with this fungus has the impulse to climb. It climbs and climbs and climbs to the top of the canopy, locks its mandible into a leaf, and then boing, these mushrooms come out, and the spores get dispersed far and wide. So it's very bizarre that the fungi that parasitize insects are medically significant to humans and mammals. So I started looking at cordyceps, and Dusty and I, we grow lots of cordyceps sinensis, which is the previous one. And then we have carpenter ants here, and this is a photograph by Richard Gaines, and this is cordyceps macrophylia, which has an affinity to ants, and shows you, and there's 400 to 500 species of cordyceps in the genome so far identified. But cordyceps is an extremely interesting genus because it's a dimorphic fungus. The mushroom is a perfect state. Two spores got to come together, fuse, and then downstream mycelium is binucleate and dikaryotic. But it has an alternative life cycle. And this in the genus Metarhizium. And this is one of my huge discoveries. And I just received a patent from the U.S. Patent Office, two patents actually. And I have another series of patents that are pending on this. This is Metarhizium, which is the mold state of cordyceps. So many of these Metarhizium is the most common parasitizing fungus against insects in the world. Up to 25% of the spore mass in soils is Metarhizium. The soil is a lethal plateau for insects. And so they're in contact with these Metarhizium spores, which can parasitize them, and they're trying to avoid them at all costs. So the social insects, termites and ants that have a queen, are called factory fortresses because they prevent workers from bringing in the spores from the soil into the colony. Many patents by Bayer, Monsanto, and Dow have been issued on using spores of Metarhizium as a biopesticide. They have not made it to market. The reason being is that when you can dust the insects with these spores and you can kill the insects. But when you're trying to treat a queen colony, you can't get to the queen with spores. So the queen and the colony is set up to avoid infection from these spores. So if workers come in with spores on them, they are pushed out and prevented from entry into the colony. So the view of the pesticide industry, and unfortunately of the pharmas, etc., is this archaic, male-dominated perspective of let's go ahead and kill insects with missiles, spores. More spores, more missile, more death, more destruction, we've treated the problem. You know, I thought to myself, as I'm watching the carpenter ants walk across my house, you know, that this is, you know, I need to get rid of these ants. So I ordered cultures that were approved by the EPA. The last thing I want is airborne spores in my laboratory. We don't want any molds in our laboratory. So, and propagating cultures, and I did hundreds and hundreds of transfers. And then I got what we call sectors. These white wedge of growth, which leads to a cordyceps mushroom, which does not produce spores. And I said, well, hallelujah, now I got a culture that I can work with. And the scientific literature, people stated over and over that the sectors, when they form, are a sign of degeneration, and spores are not being formed, and hence the cultures are avoided. And so the pesticide industry went to potentiating spore production every way they could, more conidia, more spores per gram, and greater lethality. So I chased sectors. This is the basis of my patent. And then I morphed the culture from this state here into a white form. Exact same organism. And now it's in a pre-conidial, pre-sporulating state. And then I stumbled on something that was huge. My daughter, who's 16 years old at the time, Dusty and I and her, we made a good theater out of it. We made a game with kids. You know, and I said, we're going to kill the carpenter ants with mycelium. And so I asked my daughter for a doll dish, and she went to her Barbie doll collection, which she wasn't using anymore, and she gave me a little doll dish. I grew up the mycelium on rice. I put it at this place where every morning I'm vacuuming up all the sawdust. And so I put it down there, and thank God, my daughter had to go pee at 1 o'clock in the morning. And she walks by, and she looks down at the dish, and she goes, oh, my goodness. She comes into our room and said, Paul, Dusty, wake up, you got to see this. We get out, and we look at the dish. It's covered with carpenter ants. The carpenter ants took the mycelium, no repellency, no spores. They took the mycelium, they retreated back into the house, and then 2 weeks later, no carpenter ants. For 5 years, even though we have houses falling down, and there's wood stacked up, and there's carpenter ants all over the place, the carpenter ants have refused to go back into the house. And so we have found something that is incredible. The ants swarm over the mycelium, and it goes through the factory fortress's barriers. It's presented to the queen. We've done 3 years now of studies at Texas A&M University with Dr. Roger Gold. I can talk about this because the patents have been approved. And he has said, I've never seen anything like this in my life as an entomologist. He is a testing facility for Dow, Monsanto, all the big pesticide companies. He says, you've got something here that's huge. And so we start doing experiments. And what we do is we use the natural genome as a source of the insects, as a source of the cultures. Because it is localized, it doesn't create an insect plague that spreads outside of the colony. Once the colony is killed, other insects won't go near it. So they don't engage the spores or the cultures, which later form, because they have avoidance and repellency. And so now we have tried this against, and we've been approved for 8 species of carpenter ants. We're 100% effective against fire ants, for which there's no cure, there's no treatment. We're effective against the eastern subterranean termites called reticular termes flavipes. We are also 100% effective against Coptotermes formanosanus, which is the Formosan, the Formosan termite. And so I've gone back to the patent office about 6 months ago, and they challenged me. And it was a great situation, because I'm the kind of the ex, you know, hippie, or Dusty, the present hippie, coming in, and they haven't seen anybody like us. I'll stop here in just a minute. Okay. And I went in there and I said, you know, I sat there with the patent examiner, I'm going to say some crazy things, but I believe in natural intelligence. The fungi are intelligent. He said, just a second, please. He reached for the phone and he got, security, get up here right away. he was joking. But we have been approved. This is phenomenal, because we can now steer beneficial insects by doing extracts. And we have also effective against forage and dung flies, non-social insects. It is a revolutionary patent breakthrough. It's been called the Alexander Graham Bell patent, because it looks like it will be effective against every insect in the world. And so we can then be target specific because the fungi that come from the insects are more attractive to that host insect than they are to non-targeted insects. So I just came from the EPA biopesticide division, and the four regulators who are the gatekeepers on approving us for a novel mycopesticide had grins on their face that they could not suppress. They were just like, they couldn't believe it because they've been seeing patent application and pesticide applications coming in left and right, and nobody had discovered this. This is a new subscience between fungi and insects, which could replace all chemicals, pesticides in the world. Thank you very much.